This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 25th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley, California. Reaction to Bush's peace plan for the Middle East from Palestinians living in the middle of the brutal occupation. Security is tight with the G8 summit set to begin in Calgary, Canada. And with the FBI now investigating scuba divers, people in Massachusetts rally against the US Patriot Act. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, Secretary General Kofi Annan took issue with many points raised by President Bush in his speech on the Middle East. Heather Risby has more from the United Nations.
Commenting on President Bush's speech, the Secretary General made it clear that he was not fully in line with Washington on the question of how to bring peace to the Middle East. Speaking to reporters this morning, Kofi Annan raised a number of questions about the viability of President Bush's proposal on the change of Palestinian leadership and elections. He also recognized Yasser Arafat as a legitimately elected leader of the Palestinian people and said he hoped the reforms will not be a condition for the peace process to be moving forward. The Secretary General indicated that officials from the UN, the European Union, and Russia will soon be having discussions with Washington with regard to organizing an international peace conference on the Middle East. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
An estimated 3,000 white farmers in Zimbabwe were supposed to stop farming yesterday at midnight, but many are challenging those land reforms. Zoe Eisenstein explains.
Many farmers crossed the deadline to quit their land, even though they now face the threat of up to 2 years in jail or a fine of more than $350. A new reform law affecting nearly 3,000 white farmers is supposed to enable President Robert Mugabe's government to resettle their property with black farmers. The Commercial Farmers Union says that more than 200,000 farm workers are also affected. The law came into effect on May the 10th. And gave farmers 45 days to stop working their land. Farmers who defied the order said 45 days didn't give them enough time to wind up their operations, and some of them are now resorting to the courts to challenge the policy. This is Zoe Eisenstein for Free Speech Radio News.
A U.S. Senate committee began the process of pulling apart President Bush's request to develop the Office of Homeland Security. Gareth Schweitzer has more from the Capitol.
Although witnesses at today's hearing were supportive of the president's basic proposal, there were numerous questions regarding the formation and scope of powers the new agency would possess. Tim Edgar of the ACLU says the plan would encourage secrecy by muzzling whistleblowers and limiting citizen input.
The president's proposal is that it makes the Homeland Security, shrouds it in a cloak of secrecy and eviscerates many of the laws that make those agencies accountable to the public.
Civil rights groups critical of last year's Patriot Act are also concerned that the new agency would not respect privacy laws. The Patriot Act enhanced the government's right to surveillance last year and even enabled law enforcement to inspect the library records of suspected terrorists. The plan for the new cabinet agency was formulated in secrecy without input from governmental and non-governmental experts and includes organizations such as FEMA, which are highly effective in their current capacity in aiding in non-terrorist disasters. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Late yesterday, the bankruptcy judge in the Enron case decided to make sure severance packages going to laid-off employees would be slightly more equitable. Renee Feltz has more from Houston.
On Monday, U.S. bankruptcy judge Arthur Gonzalez approved a multimillion-dollar agreement that could triple the maximum severance pay received by former Enron employees. According to lawyers representing the workers, the deal was struck earlier this month and gives each worker up to $13,500 in severance. Previous payments averaged only $5,000. The judge handed down his decision after reviewing a recently released statement of Enron's financial affairs that detailed $100 million in bonuses paid to hundreds of Enron executives and other top-level employees as they presided over the company's descent into bankruptcy. Employees and investors who lost money in Enron's collapse are now seeking to have these bonuses rescinded and used toward a potential damage settlement. I'm Renee Feltz in Houston for Free Speech Radio News.
Some students at a New Brunswick high school protested when the valedictorian gave a commencement speech in English and Spanish. Scott Gurian has more from New Jersey.
When 17-year-old Angela Salazar and her family immigrated from Ecuador 4 years ago, she spoke only a few words of English. Now at the top of her class at New Brunswick High School, Salazar insisted on delivering last night's graduation address in both English and Spanish. She did it for the benefit of audience members, including her relatives who speak little English. "Not saying anything in Spanish is denying who I am and where I came from," she said. More than half of the students at the school are Hispanic, and 40% are native Spanish speakers. Yet, as Salazar began the Spanish part of her speech, 24 of her classmates turned their backs on her, and audience members responded with both heckling and applause. In New Jersey, this is Scott Gurian for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Israeli soldiers stormed the Palestinian headquarters in the city of Hebron earlier this morning, occupying the 7th of 8 main West Bank centers. 4 Palestinian policemen were killed. The attack came as Israeli and Palestinian leaders expressed widely divergent views on a Mideast policy speech delivered yesterday by President Bush. Katha Mester reports from Ramallah.
Israeli tanks and armored personnel carriers continue to patrol the streets of Ramallah today, enforcing another day of curfew. While the city remains under a strict Israeli-imposed curfew, an ambulance provided the transport for this reporter to the offices of the Union of Palestinians Medical Relief Committee, where Dr. Mustafa Barghouti works to distribute medicine and food to the citizens of Ramallah. In his speech, Bush said the United States would only recognize a Palestinian state when Israelis can live in peace and security.
The road to the vision is absolutely Israeli in the speech. And in that sense, it wasn't balanced at all. Because when it spoke about security, as if it was talking about only about the Israeli security, and nothing was said about Palestinian security. Ironically, this was said at the time when Israeli tanks are occupying every Palestinian city, and when Palestinian Authority has already lost its authority completely.
Barghouti says the Palestinian people are committed to democratic reform, but he says the reforms demanded by the Bush administration cannot be implemented until Israeli troops withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza. Barghouti believes international intervention is necessary to help achieve the goals Bush outlined in his Middle East initiative.
What he didn't say is that the Israeli army must withdraw immediately. What he must have said, should have said, is that there would be deployment immediately of international forces on the ground. Believe me, this is the only way to achieve a beginning of true security. And of course, that would be the precondition for arranging elections. There is a need for, of course, you cannot have elections immediately because we need first an election law and we need Israeli withdrawal so that at least candidates could campaign. At the moment, how can you run elections? So there are many conditions that are needed, and I don't think they can be guaranteed without true international presence on the ground.
In his speech, George Bush said, quote, "Peace required a new and different Palestinian leadership." Bush also said when the Palestinians accept new leadership, that could lead to an independent Palestinian state. But today, Palestinian Authority Chair Yasser Arafat downplayed that statement. When asked by the BBC if Bush had called for his removal, he replied, quote, "Definitely not." Ziad Abu Zayed, a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council.
You know that Arafat is under siege and the Palestinian Security Service was destroyed. So physically, they cannot be able to function on the ground. And Arafat is restricted to Ramallah. And so how can you consider Arafat responsible and put the blame on him? If he is not allowed to work, and if he is not able to work, and if all his security services are destroyed and stripped from their weapons, and many of them are still in the Israeli jails.
Even though Bush alluded to a 3-year timetable until a full Palestinian state could be established, in the meantime, Jonathan Kutab, Palestinian human rights attorney with Al-Haq, says Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is changing the situation on the ground.
The only security for Israel comes from peace, from its acceptance. And we are willing. We have made offers, not just the Palestinians, the entire Arab nation through the Saudi initiative. The entire international community has made the same point. The reality is, though, that Sharon and many Israelis with him simply want to keep the land. They want to build settlements. They want to take land. And as long as they are doing it, they will use every means at their disposal, as they have been doing, and it will be to no avail. In the end, this occupation will be terminated.
Again, Palestinian Legislative Council member Ziad Abu Zayed.
Time is very important. And Israel was all the time trying to create facts on the ground and to create more obstacles in front of any future withdrawal. And therefore, any proposal, any idea, it should have a timetable and it should have a mechanism how to be implemented. And it should not be only a declaration of principles and leaving the parties where they are now. This is not conducive to any peace-making. And therefore, we urge the American administration to try to find a timetable and a mechanism how to translate this speech into action.
For Free Speech Radio News in Ramallah, I'm Qatam Esther.
As the FBI investigates the possibility of al-Qaeda operatives mounting an attack on Los Angeles through Catalina Island, it's also cracking down on millions of U.S. citizens who are certified for recreational scuba diving. Based on information gleaned through what the FBI calls interviews with detainees at Guantanamo Bay and other intelligence sources, the FBI released a public advisory on May 23rd that terrorists were seeking to use scuba gear for underwater sabotage. Patrick Burke has this report.
Laura Bosley is a spokeswoman for the Los Angeles branch of the FBI. According to Bosley, the FBI caught wind of a Catalina Island plot through interviews at Guantanamo Bay. In addition to records produced by the two major international scuba associations, the FBI has begun seeking information from some of the 1,200 to 1,500 dive shops around the country, asking owners to look out for what they call suspicious customers.
They may feel uncomfortable about it, and certainly understandable, but Our job is to enforce the law, and so we would not be doing our job if we didn't take, you know, these types of precautions. We're not going to stop doing it because of, you know, perhaps complaints about it.
Louisiana, Ohio, North Dakota, and Southern California are among the FBI's recent stops. While most dive shop owners have been cooperative, at least one in Florida refused to turn over its students' information, but did so when it was subpoenaed. Ken Curtis is the co-owner of Reef Seekers Dive Company in Beverly Hills. His shop has had only initial contact with the FBI, but he plans to refuse if the FBI requests his students' information.
If someone doesn't stand up, then no one's going to, and then what's the check, you know, on government intrusion and a government gone wild? Unfortunately, one of the problems with our post-9/11 world is we've gone from innocent until proven guilty to suspect everybody. And, you know, that's not something, again, as an American citizen that I'm, you know, really too nuts about.
Although Curtis says he would comply if issued a subpoena, he points out that the FBI could be collecting private information such as medical records and credit card information. In addition to what Curtis calls an invasion of divers' civil liberties, he says the investigation approach is misguided. Curtis explains that underwater demolition would require extremely advanced training, unlike the basic information given by dive shops.
If you want to go in undetected, you're going to have to be dropped way outside, let's say like in Los Angeles, way outside of Angel's Gate. And when you're dealing with an average visibility there of maybe 1 foot, navigating your way underwater through the channel is, you know, especially for someone who's only completed a basic class, the joke about basic divers is they can barely navigate their way back out to their car in the parking lot, let alone through an entire harbor with no visibility.
What worries divers is the complicity of the two major diving certification associations with the FBI investigation. These two organizations voluntarily gave information on all of their members certified in the last 3 years, about 3 million people. The lists consist of divers' names, addresses, and levels of certification, and possibly other information. Jeff Nadler is the Vice President of Industry and Government Relations for the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, or PADI, based in Southern California. He explains the conditions under which this information was handed over to the FBI.
First of all, that they acknowledged that it was a proprietary list. Secondly, that it was only to be used for their investigation into possible terrorist activities using scuba, that it would not be used for any other purpose, and once they'd completed their investigation, it would be returned to us.
Nadler says that his organization also got the FBI to agree not to share the information on its students with any other government agency. Cindy Cohen is the legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the largest online civil liberties organization in the world. She is also a PADI-certified diver. Cohen says that the FBI is engaged in a fishing expedition. She says they lack probable cause to collect private information and begin surveillance on U.S. citizens simply because they have basic diving certification. Had Patty required the FBI to get a subpoena, the approved subpoena may have been more targeted and less intrusive on millions of divers.
Patty prevented me from standing up for my privacy because they didn't tell me that they were handing this over, and they didn't give me the opportunity to go to a judge and say, wait a minute, you know, the FBI has absolutely no basis to suspect me, and they have to have at least some basis before they get my private information.
Indeed, only 5 commercial diving schools around the country train people in practices that could pose a clear security risk. At these facilities, students learn how to build and repair sensitive infrastructure underwater. Tamara Brown is a spokeswoman for the Divers Academy International in New Jersey.
We train divers to build oil rigs, to look at petro pipelines, to build bridges, to look at our nuclear power plants and do maintenance on our nuclear power plants.
Brown says the Divers Academy has been in communication with the FBI since November and is cooperating however it can, mostly by turning over names and nationalities of its students. She says Academy officials will be meeting with Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge within the next few weeks. Meanwhile, the FBI will continue to tour the nation's dive shops, seeking more information about recreational scuba divers. In Los Angeles, I'm Patrick Burke for Free Speech Radio News.
The G8 summit gets underway tomorrow in a remote Canadian resort town. Security will be extraordinarily tight for the discussions, with memories of last year's violent crackdown in Genoa, Italy, in which one protester was killed by police and hundreds were injured. Over the weekend, 5,000 people marched through downtown Calgary to protest the Group of Eight's economic and political powers. The G8 nations control NATO and the International Monetary Fund. The centerpiece of their proposed public policy is a development and aid package for Africa. Security enforcement of the downtown area and the remote mountain resort of Kananskis, which will host the heads of state and their ministers, is now in full effect. Thatcher Collins reports from Calgary.
Welcome to the Calgary Area G8 Information Line, your resource for G8 information. G8 Summit Security has determined that in the interests of public safety and traffic ingress and egress around the TELUS Convention Center, Hyatt Regency Hotel, an access control area will be established around a 2-block section of downtown Calgary for 3 days during the week of the summit.
The operation around Kananaskis is the largest peacetime military operation in Canadian history. 5,000 soldiers hold a security perimeter enclosed within the mountains using missile launchers, helicopters, fighter jets, tanks, and jeeps. Checkpoints on the roadways into the region check for demonstrators. The mainstream media and public officials are helping to cultivate a fear of violent protests in this conservative, oil-driven area. This health ad has been aired on local radio stations.
What if? That's a question that the Calgary Health Region has been answering for months in preparation for the G8 summit. It's a question we've posed because of the potential emergencies, but also because we're dedicated to providing you with normal access to health care, no matter what happens.
School teachers were asked to keep their children inside this week. Royal Canadian Mounted Police spokespeople Michael Riley and John Milton Hope outlined the driving perception of the protests.
There are certain organization realities within the activist movement, as well as within the police culture, as well as within Calgary as a community, as a culture, as well as within the Bow Valley corridor.
And these would be more towards the anarchist kind of conduct, where they're prepared to cause property damage, and they think that there's nothing, you know, the property damage is part of the process, or people may be injured as a result of that. That won't be tolerated.
Activists tried to set up a village near Kananaskis on the Stoney Indian Reservation, but the Stoneys changed their mind after they received $300,000 from the government. Churches that had originally offered to house activists have been closing their doors after objections from fearful community members. Locals are outright hostile to activists walking in Calgary and entering restaurants. The mayor has blocked the use of public spaces in downtown for protests this week. The rally yesterday was the police-endorsed Family and Labor March, and the only one not facing some sort of crackdown. Canada denied visas to 58 Third World delegates to a counter-conference this week, many of them from Africa. Zimbabwe activist David Kaguru did make it and spoke to the rally.
We are not so blind as those who will not see. We are not so dumb as those who will not recollect. We recollect that it was the Gang of Eight that was behind colonization. It is the Gang of Eight that was behind the Cold War and the creation of the largest group of disabled persons on the African continent in Angola. We recognize it is the Gang of Eight that has ensured that the resolution of the Palestinian question does not see the light of day. We recognize that it is the Gang of Eight that has continued to manufacture poor people and poverty and to keep the workers of the world unshackled in systems that are unjust. Africa is yet to be compensated for the debt that multinational corporations in cahoots with the governments of the G8 continue to cause on Africa. It is the Gang of Eight that represents undemocraticness, that represents repression, that represents bondage. We come from Africa with a clear message. Only we, the people, are our own liberators. Only we, the people, in solidarity with each other throughout the world, can cause this world to become a better place. Good governance means people governance. Power to the people. Power to the people. Down with global apartheid. Down with global apartheid.
The G8 meeting starts on Wednesday. Thatcher Collins, Free Speech Radio News, Calgary.
With some Loya Jirga delegates still discussing details of the next government, appointed ministers are taking their seats to begin their task of running the country for the next 2 years. But as Fariba Nawa reports from Kandahar, not much seems to have changed from the previous transitional government rule. And to the dismay of many Afghans, the warlords are still ruling.
What Afghans feared most has happened. The Loya Jirga reinforced warlords' power and legitimized their hold on the country for the next 2 years. General Qasim Fahim and Abdullah Panshiris, who represent a fraction of the population, kept two of the three key posts, the defense and foreign ministries, respectively. Abdullah's reinstatement hasn't angered Afghans as much as Fahim's. President Hamid Karzai also made Fahim one of his presidential advisors, in addition to appointing him to the most important and powerful ministry. Many say Karzai had no choice because the Panjshiris have the guns. Yunus Qanani's token resignation from the Interior Ministry early on in the Loya Jirga was a ploy to show people that the Panjshiris don't want all the power. But when Karzai gave the Interior Ministry to a Pashtun, the governor of Wardak province, the predominantly Panjshiri employees of that ministry protested and demanded Qanani's reinstatement. Karzai held strong and appointed Qanani Minister of Education instead and his security advisor. Qanani, one of the most articulate leaders in Afghanistan, accepted the post after much discussion and debate. He also threatened that he would form his own political party. Meanwhile, Karzai is expected to oust Seema Samat, the controversial women's affairs minister. She was in favor of a secular government during Loya Jirga proceedings and since has received death threats, and conservative Islamists called her the Salman Rushdie of Afghanistan in a newspaper ad. So a conservative Herati woman is due to replace Samar's position. Karzai made one shrewd move by appointing two powerful warlords in central and eastern Afghanistan also as his advisors, in an attempt to diminish their regional power and strengthen the central government. His real advisors are mostly Afghans who have lived 20 years in the West. With all this, Afghans aren't happy, but they're not taking to the streets to protest or attempting any coups. They're patient. They say they waited 23 years for peace, and maybe in 2 years, when this government's time is up, they can have a representative Loya Jirga free of bribery and intimidation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Kandahar.
The American Civil Liberties Union has been working overtime defending basic rights that certain immigrants and even U.S. citizens of Arab descent seem to be losing. The U.S. Patriot Act has led to hundreds of these people being arrested and held without charge or the right to see an attorney or even family members. But in Massachusetts, people are organizing in defense of their rights. From Boston, Chuck Racina reports.
On Saturday, over 1,000 people rallied on the Boston Common to say no to the U.S. Patriot Act and yes to the Bill of Rights. Resistance to the U.S. Patriot Act is growing in Massachusetts, where Cambridge recently became the fourth city or town in the state to say that they will uphold the Bill of Rights over the U.S. Patriot Act. Howard Zinn, a well-known author and activist for People's Struggles, was among the many to address the rally.
We need to remind the government and to remind ourselves of the Declaration of Independence, which they would like to forget about, because the Declaration of Independence is a founding philosophical document of democracy and of this nation. And the Declaration of Independence says that governments are artificial creations. And according to the Declaration of Independence, when governments become destructive of these rights, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish this government. It is not unpatriotic to question government policies. It is unpatriotic to violate the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And so it is the government that is being unpatriotic.
Howard Zinn addressing the Civil Liberties Union Anti-Patriot Act rally on the Boston Common last Saturday. Massachusetts State Representative Byron Rushing moved the crowd with eloquent declarations of freedom.
This is a nation of immigrants. Believe it or not. Those people who were on the Mayflower, those people who went to Jamestown, were all illegal, all undocumented. And every Thanksgiving, we commemorate the fact that the indigenous people here did not fingerprint them. We commemorate the fact that the indigenous people did not have an INS. And so our job is to stand up for freedom. And I ask you to join with me and declare this land free. Let us declare Boston free!
Massachusetts State Representative Byron Rushing.
Well, this is an event organized by the Civil Liberties Task Force.
Nancy Murray is with the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union and was the main coordinator of the rally.
It's an effort, really, to get some momentum going in the state to roll back sections of the USA Patriot Act and really raise consciousness about how our rights are being put in the trash can. The motto of this day is, with our rights under siege, our unity is our strength. And instead of the asinine United We Stand stuff, which really is us against them, you know, we unite, but let them pay the price. We're talking about real unity here, unity of the people.
My name is Volja, and this is an insurrection. And we out here for the get up, stand up for your rights rally, because our rights are under attack. We're here to chant down the Patriot Act. And we want to set the record straight right now by pointing out we don't live in a democracy, only hypocrisy. This first song goes out to Timothy Thomas, the young black man shot down in Cincinnati, Ohio, last year.
Special thanks to reporter Nancy Horn for her contribution to this story. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina on the Boston Common.
Rubber bullet and a beanbag, yeah.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mesta and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelli, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.